Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we have an update on devastating wildfires burning statewide and a special report on those rolling power outages in our state. We'll have the latest news on our county's progress in getting off a state watch list for COVID-19 and moving towards reopening schools. We have a warning on a deadly poison being falsely touted as a cure for COVID-19. And we'll have info on new relief funds for renters and businesses in La Mesa. Plus, we'll have an interview with Jack Hsu, a candidate running for the La Mesa City Council. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Record-shattering temperatures and over 12,000 lightning strikes have resulted in hundreds of wildfires across California. Locally, we have not had any fires yet. However, temperatures reached a scorching 118 degrees in Borrego Springs and a record-shattering 107 degrees in Campo. Now, as of Friday, our show taping deadline, nearly 12,000 firefighters are battling about two dozen major fires that have burned over 771,000 acres statewide, destroying at least 660 buildings. Five people have died, including a former Channel 10 News helicopter pilot. The fires are ravaging much of Northern California. That includes major damage in Big Basin State Park, home to giant sequoia redwood trees. The UC Santa Cruz campus has been evacuated, along with many communities in Northern California. The SCO Lightning Complex Fire, currently the largest in the state, has charred over 250,000 acres in Contra Costa, Alameda, Santa Clara, and Stanislaus counties. It's only 10% contained. The LNU Lightning Complex Fire in Napa has burned over 219,000 acres and is only 7% contained. Firefighters are making progress on some fires, despite extreme weather conditions, containing some blazes. But in other areas, fire officials and residents report not enough firefighters are available to stop the destruction, the San Jose Mercury News reports. That's in part due to some inmate fires impacted by COVID-19. Fire officials warn residents statewide to be ready to evacuate early, as fire danger is still high. Please avoid anything that could spark a fire and have your evacuation plans ready. You can learn more about how to prepare for a wildfire at readyforwildfire.org. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
Power outages are particularly disruptive during the pandemic, with millions of Californians working from home and educating children at home. Many have nowhere to go to escape the heat during an outage, with libraries and other public facilities closed due to COVID-19. Governor Gavin Newsom voiced outrage and ordered an investigation. He also signed an emergency proclamation that temporarily allows some energy users and utilities to use backup energy sources to relieve pressure on the grid during peak times in an energy emergency. Meanwhile, CAISO is pointing the finger at the Public Utilities Commission, or PUC, claiming it has been warning the PUC to take preventative steps for years to make utility companies assure that they've lined up emergency backup energy sources, but CAISO says the PUC ignored those warnings. Some SDG&E customers experienced brief rolling blackouts of approximately an hour last weekend, August 15th and 16th. The utility warned of potential outages again on Monday, August 17th, to up to 100,000 customers, but was able to prevent these thanks to residents and businesses heeding the call to cut back on power usage during high energy demand periods between 4 and 9 p.m. SDG&E used emails, text messages, robocalls, and notices sent to media to get word out, as well as appealing directly to major energy users to reduce consumption. And it worked. However, additional outages are possible as the heat wave continues. Newsom, in a press conference, says he wants to make sure rolling blackouts never happen again in the state of California. CAISO apologized for not alerting the governor earlier, but CAISO chief Steve Berberic says the ISO has been warning the PUC for years that shortages were possible in utilities such as Pacific Gas and Electric didn't line up enough backup power in advance. but the PUC has failed to take action. The resource adequacy program is broken, Babarich told the Sacramento Bee. The PUC did not respond to the Bee's request for comments. Still, some things have improved since the last major rolling blackouts in our state nearly two decades ago in 2001. Back then, outages last for longer in California. In some states, the situation has gotten even worse. In August 2003, Northeast Blackout in Ohio crashed regional grids, leaving 50 million people in eight states and Canada from 24 hours up to several weeks. Energy efficiency of appliances and buildings have also improved over the past 20 years, as has the ability to communicate the need for conservation to consumers and large energy users during extreme weather conditions. Most importantly, nowadays, California's grid is much better managed, said Pat Remick, senior energy communications strategist with the National Resource Defense Council. That's in part because our state is interconnected with a power system across western states. So during the current extreme heat, hydroelectric power from the Pacific Northwest has helped keep lights on in California. California is also relying on a growing portfolio of wind, solar, and geothermal renewable resources. Remick says that's a far better and cheaper reliability strategy than running dirty energy diesel generators on hot afternoons only in densely populated places. That said, to avert blackouts this past week, some fossil fuel plants were utilized. Newsom says California remains committed to moving away from fossil fuels towards solar and wind, which the state has dramatically increased in recent years as the state moves towards an economy fueled by green, renewable energy that also reduces pollution and greenhouse gas emissions in order to combat climate change. Still, Newsom acknowledged we cannot sacrifice reliability as we move forward in this transition. Allstate residents are being asked to conserve electric power while the heat wave continues. You can do this by setting your thermostat to 78 degrees or higher between 3 and 10 p.m. and refrain from using major appliances during those hours. You can refrain from major appliance use between 3 and 10 p.m. as well. Also, turn off any unnecessary lights and appliances, charge medical devices, and have a backup plan in case the power goes out. Keep windows and doors closed to prevent the loss of cool or heated air during the day. On summer nights, open the windows to let cooler air in if safe in your area. Have flashlights on hand, keep your cell phone charged, and be sure you have a battery-powered radio to stay in communication during outages. You can also park your car outside, leave your garage door open, or be sure you know how to manually open the garage door in case you need to run errands or evacuate during a power outage. And please, check in on neighbors, friends, and family who may be at risk. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Sepulveda.
San Diego County reached an important milestone on Tuesday when the state removed the county from California's watch list for COVID-19. The change was made after the county's rate of new COVID-19 cases dropped below 100 cases per 100,000 people. San Diego had been on the watch list since July 3rd. What this means is that if the case rate stays under 100 per 100,000 people in the population for another 11 days until August 31st, schools will be allowed to reopen. Each elementary, middle school, and high school district will have a choice of resuming in-class instruction, continuing virtual learning, or a combination of both. Businesses, however, will not be able to resume normal activities until the county receives more guidance from the state. So, for now, closed businesses must remain shut down and those operating outdoors cannot go back inside. While new cases have fallen, the county remains out of compliance with its own regulations regarding community outbreaks. The trigger is anything more than 6 community outbreaks in 7 days, meaning limits must continue to be imposed on certain businesses and activities until the outbreaks are reduced below that level. 15 community outbreaks in 7 days occurred in our county as of Thursday, August 20th. The county has exceeded the trigger for community outbreaks for many weeks in a row, often at triple or more the threshold level. A community outbreak is defined as 3 or more COVID-19 cases in a community setting among people of different households. County Public Health Officer Dr. Wooten urges San Diegans to continue to wear face coverings, keep 6 feet apart, avoid large gatherings, frequently wash your hands, and stay home if you're sick. Those steps can also help accelerate reopening of schools as well as businesses struggling with months-long closures and restrictions, also helping put people back to work. The economic hardships felt by many are worsening this month after Congress adjourned without extending $600 a week in extra unemployment benefits for workers affected by the pandemic. Those benefits expired July 31st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
Health experts are warning the public to steer clear of a deadly plant extract. It's called oleandrin, and it's being touted by a financial backer of President Trump as a potential cure for COVID-19. It is not. There is zero proof that it works beyond a test tube, and it has never been tested on humans. A common landscaping plant in Mediterranean climates, including Southern California, oleander is among the most poisonous plants in the world, responsible for many poisonings each year worldwide. All parts of the oleander plant are highly toxic and may be fatal, Forbes magazine reports, citing research at the University of North Carolina. According to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, consuming a single leaf can kill you, causing heart arrhythmia, gastrointestinal problems, respiratory paralysis, coma, and death. Axios reports, quote, to the alarm of some government health officials, President Trump has expressed enthusiasm for the Food and Drug Administration to permit an extract from the oleander plant to be marketed as a dietary supplement or alternatively approved as a drug to cure COVID-19, despite any lack of proof that it works. The experimental botanical extract, oleandrin, was promoted to Trump during an Oval Office visit in July. So who's behind it? Well, according to Axios, quote, it is embraced by Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson and MyPillow founder and CEO Mike Lindell, a big Trump backer. Lindell recently took a financial stake in the company that develops the product, Phoenix Biotechnology. Trump has reportedly urged the FDA to approve oleandrin, even though there is no proof that it works or is safe in humans at any dosage. The only test results available were conducted in a laboratory test tube and were not reported in any journal peer-reviewed by scientists. Medical ethnobotanist Cassandra Corvey warns, quote, this does not take into account the well-known cardiac toxicity of the chemical when consumed by an animal or human. While many substances could potentially destroy a virus in a test tube, it doesn't make them safe for people to ingest. You wouldn't swallow gasoline or plutonium or a pesticide, for example, even if such a substance were shown capable of killing the virus. Dr. Corvey is particularly worrisome that consumers may misinterpret publicity about oleander and try to self-medicate with this highly poisonous plant, or that the dietary supplements industry may try to take advantage of the public's fear of COVID-19 by developing supplements containing oleandrin. She has this message for the public. Oleander is particularly dangerous because ingesting any part of the plant can lead to serious illness and possibly death. What's more, there is no published scientific evidence on the safety of consuming oleandrin or its plant source. She concludes, it is critical that the Food and Drug Administration and its commissioner, Dr. Stephen Hahn, make certain that the public is protected from this poison. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Sepulveda.
The La Mesa City Council has voted to use federal CARES Act funding to help businesses as well as residents who need help to pay rent and utility bills. $1 million will be used to pay up to $5,000 each to local small businesses impacted by COVID-19. Applications will be accepted August 24th. These are grants, not loans, and do not have to be repaid. The city also authorized $600,000 total in grants of up to $5,000 each to help residents earning less than 80% of the area's median income. Qualifying residents can get help to pay their rent and utility bills. Another $200,000 will be used to offset the city's costs related to COVID-19, such as sanitizing parks and public buildings. The vote was 3-2. Councilmembers Akilah Weber and Colin Parent opposed because they wanted to provide residents with relief funds equal to the amount provided for businesses, as staff had recommended. The majority voted to give more to businesses and less to residents after business owners and the La Mesa Chamber President Mary England and local business owners testified to the dire economic impacts many local business owners have suffered after months of shutdowns and business disruptions. Applications for residents and businesses to apply for relief fund grants are available on the city's website. The city manager also announced changes in regulations to allow more businesses to open outdoors, and to temporarily allow fitness centers to use public parks with a permit while indoor operations are shut down due to the pandemic. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine, and I'm delighted to be here today with Jack Hsu, who is running for the La Mesa City Council. Jack is one of six candidates vying for the seat, two incumbents and four challengers. He's been an active advocate for social justice issues, environmental and homelessness issues in La Mesa for the last 30 years. He was a California State Park superintendent for 29 years, also serving as a peace officer with State Parks. As past president of the Cleveland National Forest Foundation, he worked to preserve open spaces and wilderness and change state laws to reduce pollution and build healthier communities. He served on the board of Heartland Human Relations for Human Rights as an instructor for community policing, hot topic in La Mesa right now, and as a consultant for cultural diversity. In La Mesa, he has served on the city's wellness committee, advocated for establishing a citizens task force on homelessness, and he served on the La Mesa Citizens Public Safety Oversight Task Force, which he also advocated to establish. So Jack, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start by having you tell us why you decided to run for the La Mesa City Council.
Well, I thought I was in retirement and just doing advocacy work on the side. That got me pretty busy. But after unfortunate protests and riots of May 30th, and after seeing the response from our city council and our city in general, police department and all, I felt that I need to try to help the city a bit more and continue my public service from a position of the city council and help our city deal with this issue, this crisis that we have with regards to not only just the police department, but overall governance here in La Mesa.
Yeah, I know you've told me that you reached out to La Mesa Police Chief Walt Vasquez, who is retiring later this month, before those catastrophic events of May 30th. Can you tell us what response you got and how you would have handled that whole situation differently to maybe try to prevent some of the violence and the rioting that happened after the protest?
Sure. So the days before that protest, of course, that incident at the La Mesa trolley station occurred.
Mary Johnson,
an officer, Degas. I saw that video. It was going viral through the community, and I emailed Chief Vasquez and said, you know, can I help? You need to come up with, I think, some kind of public statement or forum. Even under COVID, you could have some kind of a media event and try to answer some questions.
Right. And as backdrop, by the way, for people who may not be familiar with that incident, Amari Johnson was a young black man who was stopped by Officer Degas. Officer Degas claimed the young man had assaulted him, charged him with assault, but body cam footage failed to back up the officer's claim. Basically, it just showed the young man's fingers briefly touching the officer pushing the young man down and claiming he'd been stopped for smoking in a public space, but he had no smoking items on him when they searched him. And so it was basically perceived as racial profiling.
The charges were dropped.
There is a lawsuit, a claim against the city now, I understand, by the young man for excessive use of force and so forth. The officer is no longer with the police force, we should say, as the investigation into that continues. But at any rate, all of that occurred just days after the George Floyd killing that shocked the nation in Minneapolis, and protests and a riot there that had burned a police station down. So certainly the city was or should have been forewarned, I think. There was a lot of strong sentiments over that issue, and having a racial incident involving our own police 3 days before a protest could be a problem. Against that backdrop, tell us what you would have done differently. If you'd answered that call, what could have been done?
First, I think the police department could be a bit more forthcoming We don't have to reveal any confidential information, personnel data, or anything like that.
Right.
But just be available and to say, look, we're going to look into this, and we're taking certain actions immediately to address what happened. And I think if the chief had come out with that, that might have helped some. Unfortunately, that did not happen. That video continued to be passed around virally, so much as San Diego had seen it.
What changes would you support after everything that's happened in the police department, first and foremost, but also in the city's policies? And it seems to me there's two issues needed to restore the community trust. One is to assure everyone that there will be all efforts made to have fairness and racial justice in policing itself, but also to assure that police will be able to protect our community in the future. There were certainly a lot of merchants that were very worried that the police were locked in their station and busy with the rioters later. And meanwhile, you had dozens of businesses that got looted and three of them that were burned down.
Yeah. Well, I think to begin with, I mean, I've been working on this for pretty hard for at least a year and a half, and I'm quite familiar with law enforcement culture. And I think the tendency for the La Mesa Police Department, unfortunately, was pretty much in denial. Even after our incidents at Helix High School, where a student was essentially thrown to the ground twice by an officer in front of many students and video cameras. So we were in the state of denial that we didn't have a real problem in our police department. They're the good guys, they're good officers, maybe one or two bad apples, but they can handle that. That kind of attitude needs to change. So, you know, recently some of my friends came up with some data. Arrest records for the city of La Mesa for the past 3 years, over 13,800 arrest records showing that blacks are arrested three times at a higher rate than the city's population. The city has about 7% African Americans or blacks, but 21% of the arrests for the past 3 years have been with blacks. That's some good hard data. Unfortunately, the city doesn't even look at that data. We had to do a Freedom of Information request to get that data and crank out that data. The police department, the city council, if they're responsible, would have been at least looking at that kind of information.
Yeah, that's very troubling. And of course, we don't know to what degree people actually committed crimes, but it certainly is troubling on its face when you have, you know, such a high rate of African-American people being arrested compared to others. What does the city need to do going forward? There's some opportunities here. There's going to be a new police chief soon. We don't know who. But beyond that, what should the city be doing to eliminate racism and to make sure that the police themselves also have the resources to protect the community so we don't ever have another situation where we have buildings burning to the ground and nobody fighting fires?
Let me begin by saying I'm not anti-police. And I think
you were a peace officer for a number of years.
Yes, exactly. And
right?
If anything, we want our police department to be more effective, to be trusted.
Right.
That's the way they're going to be effective. So when we come up with proposals and ideas to improve our department, we should not be getting resistance from the department itself, from the police chief itself, or from the citizens that want to support our police department. We should be looking at these as ways to improve the department. That's the first thing that I think is important. And from there, let's give some other history. 5 years ago, the grand jury in San Diego recommended that the city of La Mesa, along with a few other cities, form a citizens review board or panel. At the time, Police Chief Vasquez said, no, we don't need one. City Council did not take any action. So we're continuing this element of denial.
Yeah.
And I think when you do that, of course, we can't really solve some real problems in our police department. So I would start from just that point of just realizing that we do have an issue to address and not treat it like we're anti-police.
What does the city need to do to be better prepared for all emergencies? I think this one happened to be a protest and riot, but kind of laid bare that the bigger problem, that they just don't seem to have the tools in place, the procedures in place for what do you do in terms of basic things like communications, communicating to the public what's going on, making sure that mutual aid requests go out. I've asked and asked and asked what mutual aid requests went out that night. And other than asking for the National Guard late at night that was denied, I haven't been able to get any. I mean, was anybody asking El Cajon police or Border Patrol or other neighboring police departments, can you send us some reinforcements to help us out here so that we can end this and protect property? But it didn't seem to happen.
Yeah. This is hindsight. So I want to be fair to the police department. We're looking at it after it has occurred. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty clear that we were ill-prepared. We were ill-prepared not only in terms of methodologies and skills to deal with large protests in the city, but also ill-prepared in terms of how to request for help and manage a large group of protesters. And then after that, we had this element of rioters. And I want to also make that distinction. The protesters and rioters are two different groups. The people who broke windows, set fires to the banks, et cetera, that's a separate group from the protesters, which for the most part were pretty peaceful.
Yeah, no, I know a lot of people citizens. Who are out there, longstanding La Mesa citizens, and you're right. I would say the vast majority of the protesters came there with nothing but peaceful intentions, and we don't really know who it was that showed up at the end there causing all of the mayhem.
Right.
It was probably not the protesters.
Right. So as it escalated, you're right. We did not have the ability to deal with that, not only in terms of numbers of police officers from other jurisdictions that could have come to help, but also in terms of our overall approach to the protest itself. Mm-hmm. And the escalation that came after.
Yeah, let's talk about the use of these. I don't even want to call them non-lethal weapons. It should be less lethal weapons, because actually things like tear gas and rubber bullets, I don't think they use those, but they did use tear gas, pepper spray, and bean bags. And these can kill people. They can cause serious injury. There was a woman who lost an eye, and you know, there's controversy over what she was doing or if she was throwing something at police. But nonetheless, what is your view on when use of these weapons is appropriate or not appropriate? Does that need to be re-looked at?
You know, one piece of information that I learned in an article that came out a few weeks after the May 30th in the LA Times was that after looking at 10 years or more of records, studies have shown that these so-called non-lethal weapons have a 3% fatality rate.
Wow.
And so I'm wondering if the commander, whoever was in charge of and gave the order to start using these items, knew that if they had started using them, that's a very good likelihood that someone was going to get either killed or have some severe injury.
Another thing that we found out through public records requests was that the incident commander there was Lieutenant Brian Stoney, not a captain, not the police chief. So that raises a whole other level of questions, you know, of why was a lieutenant, which is a relatively low-ranking officer, put in charge of such a major event.
Or the kind of experience that lieutenant may have or had.
So, yeah, maybe he'd had experience elsewhere in something like this. We don't know.
Yeah, so I'm not sure, but we know that the overall approach that the police department was having for that protest and what happened that evening was pretty much to protect the police department's facilities, the city hall, and kind of be not seen, at least for the first 4 hours of that event. And even later, they were kind of just staying in that vicinity, which, of course, we now know that lay vulnerable the rest of the city.
Yeah, there was looting at Grossmont Center, the La Mesa Springs Shopping Center, downtown La Mesa, many places.
And the fire department could not put out a fire literally two blocks from the fire department.
Yeah.
From the fire station.
Three buildings that burned all night long.
Right.
Came around occasionally and squirted water on it very, very, very late. But no firefighters on the ground. Lots of questions.
So it really showed that we were ill-prepared strategically and I think in terms of just overall how to approach all these issues. You know, to my knowledge, the rioters that evening, yes, they had bats. They may have even had Molotov cocktails here and there. But overall, it wasn't as if we were facing an army that was heavily armed and could do huge amounts of some kind of warfare type thing. Yet our police department was treating it as if they were going to be under siege in their police department. So I think that needed to be addressed in terms of how do we respond. You know, the subsequent protests that we have had in La Mesa, the police department, I think, have changed their strategy and the deployment. And that has changed, I think, the way these events are occurring now.
Yeah, we did. We saw Chief Vasquez come out and actually hug one of the African-American motorcyclists from a motorcycle group that came to protest. They've been out talking to organizers of the others to make sure they understood what the protester goals were and that there was going to be an end time to the rally. So they certainly have learned something, mm-hmm. but was that the kind of advice you would have given them to begin with? I understand you have actually mediated between police and protest groups in the city of San Diego in the past. I mean, how did that go?
Civil disobedience is part of the American tradition. It is protected under our Constitution. So it is something that I think everyone needs to respect and know that civil disobedience is something that is okay in this country. It is part of our culture and we should protect it and respect it. Obviously, violence is not something that we want. Destruction of property is not something that should occur. And for the far majority of the protesters certainly do not advocate that or participate in that. So communications, I think, is the key between law enforcement and protesters so that the law enforcement agency can be in tune with the protesters and work together to make the protest, whatever it may be, something that is manageable and that communications stays throughout the whole period. So if there's an end time, agreed end time, that both law enforcement and the protesters can agree to that and work towards that. If there's something that's happening that is harmful to protesters, to police officers, that communications is extremely helpful and they can work that out.
Yeah, you mentioned to me, I know before, that having the protest organizers themselves sort of stop people who may go over the line if somebody throws something for them to tell them you
sure.
should stop this.
Obviously, it's much more effective if people that are standing next to a protester that throws something, say something to try to avert that kind of thing from happening, that would be much more effective.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, what happened that evening of the 30th, there was a huge escalation of force. And, you know, as I may have mentioned to other people, when two people fight, when two children fight, two adults fight, the grown-ups in the room have to say, you know, we don't need to really argue who started it. Neither one of you should be fighting. Neither one of you. In fact, if there are children, both of you go to your corners and think about this for a moment, how you could have prevented this.
Okay.
And so I think that's why we have to approach this from a more sophisticated approach and say, how can we prevent this in the future and be more grown up about it rather than trying to take sides.
Very good. I'd also like to ask your view on the defender groups that have come out with ostensibly the goal of protecting businesses from being looted or damaged again, but some of them have actually been picked up for violence themselves. There was one arrested for battery of a protester and some others who have displayed, you know, knives and things that while legal are certainly intimidating. Mm-hmm. And I know that one of your opponents, Councilwoman Alicio, initially supported the group. Her boyfriend is one of the merchants who had to board up his business and everything, and of course was concerned. But she's drawn some criticism for that. She has stepped back, walked back from that somewhat in light of some of the things that some people have done with some of these defender groups. There's a La Mesa Civil Defense Group and then an East County Defenders Group, which are different, you know, same goal, but different groups that have all had a presence in La Mesa at some of the more recent protests. What are your thoughts about that?
For the La Mesa merchants, it's certainly understandable they want to protect their property. They have a right to protect their property. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's also attracted people who are really have other agendas. And of course, the Defend East County group may be more groups that are associated with hate groups, and have brought in other kinds of agendas.
Yeah, I want to make clear on that, that they have about 20,000 members according to their Facebook page. And of course, not all of them are members of hate groups. Probably most aren't, but there is that element. They've definitely had some blatant white supremacist hate group members, so to speak, who have come out and stood on the side of the defenders and have been engaged in everything from, you know, fist fights to shouting racial slurs at people. Mm-hmm. So it's a definite concern. Just like on both sides, you sometimes have extremist elements, just as the protesters don't want to be associated with people that are rioting and looting and burning for the most part. You know, the defenders are a mixed bag as well of people with peaceful intents and some people who don't have peaceful intents.
Absolutely. There may be a mixed bag on both sides in a certain degree, but let's make it clear. During this time of our country, we've been leaning and relying on our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, to give us some civility and some guidance. The Constitution does not give us the right to hate. The Constitution does not say that we can go out and essentially be hateful and be almost aggressive in that approach. The Constitution does give us the right of free speech, but free speech is, I think, a bit different than promoting harm, direct right. harm to others.
Right.
And I think let's make that distinction. These are two different groups in here that we're talking about.
Let's switch gears for a moment and talk about some additional topics. How would you balance the need for housing in our region, including affordable units, something that the state is pushing all of the cities to do, against the concerns of those who want to protect community character and, in the case of the Village, the historic charm?
Well, the historic charm of the Village is something that is important to La Masons, certainly those who live there. But this idea that some developers have, that they have to build high rises in order to make the development profitable, I think that should be brought into question.
So you wouldn't have been a fan of the Park Place or Park Station project a few years ago, where they wanted to put an 18-story building up right next
exactly.
to the historic district.
And that kind of development, I think, has certain things that not only are out of character for La Mesa, but I think there are other issues that such high-rises cause in a social context. My background is in recreation, and long ago, 30 years ago, we learned that when you build high-rises more than five stories up, at least for children, they don't get to go outdoors anymore. So that we already have this problem of children glued to screens as we are during this COVID time. If we're going to have any chance of getting children outdoors and recreating and dealing with obesity and dealing with learning about the outdoors and interacting with other children, other people, and then we should really be critical of high rises. And maybe about four or five stories is all we need. The first story being commercial and other stories being residential. Many communities throughout the world are based on that kind of model, and they have the most beautiful cultural, you know, commerce and economies based on that kind of development. We have only so much space left in La Mesa. We're not going to be, you know, building huge number of homes. But if we go forward with that kind of idea in terms of what kind of city we want to be in the future and built in that perspective, we can accommodate more people, because obviously affordable housing is also related to homelessness.
So we're going to talk about that in depth in a moment, but yeah.
Yeah, so let's see that this is a bigger issue, and we have to approach it with some real thought.
With the three buildings that burned down in La Mesa, one of which I guess Union Bank has said they want to rebuild, the other two, and they own their property, the other two, I'm told, lease the property. It's a little uncertain what's going to happen with those. Councilman Parent has said this could be an opportunity to re-envision or even recreate part of downtown, especially since there's also some other businesses that have closed and folded. Maybe create a, you know, piazza or a town square or mixed use or some public uses, perhaps, of some of those lots. You know, there's been a lot of fighting downtown about where to permanently put a farmer's market or what happens to the library we were promised years ago where the funding disappeared and that kind of went away. What options do you think should be considered for the downtown area, specifically those areas where we had burned or shuttered properties that might be available for something else?
Well, I think we need to pursue this from a bigger lens. We have some properties and options, unfortunately, due to these fires that occurred. But the other lens that we have to look at, or the other issues we have to look at, is how do we make our communities more walkable and usable and friendly? Mm-hmm. And once you bring that into light, then we need to really look at the general plan process and how we can increase this kind of environment. You know, right now with the COVID thing, there's a huge rush to put restaurants outside so that they can continue to be in business.
Right.
Well, you know, La Mesa has experience in that because every Oktoberfest and during Christmas holiday season, we close down La Mesa Boulevard.
That's true. There's the beer garden and everybody eats bratwurst outside.
We do all kinds of things, and commerce helps. It is part of the character now of La Mesa. People come in by trolley and go and shop and have commerce. It's a boost. Now, with COVID happening, maybe we're not going to have huge crowds.
But yeah, no Oktoberfest this year. It's been canceled for this time.
Yeah, that's been canceled. But however, that kind of environment, at some point, we can create and prosper from. And to me, we need to think in that light. There are communities, whether it's Little Italy in San Diego, the gas lamp area, they have experimented with that. They've closed down the gas lamp area, Fifth Street, at least during the weekends, every weekend for a while, they're going to do that just to promote the businesses and make it more safer as well as more attractive. We can create that kind of environment in La Mesa. These properties might give us that option, give us a reason to move in that direction. And I think that needs to be thought out. It needs the involvement of the community as we move in that direction.
What about areas other than downtown? We hear a lot of focus on that area. Naturally, there's parking meter money and so forth, you know, that gets fed into the city from that. But La Mesa has many other neighborhoods, too, that sometimes don't get as much attention. Do you have any ideas for some of those?
I think I have a lot of hopes for those communities. When I say a vibrant La Mesa from one end to the other, I mean El Cajon Boulevard, University, Grossmont Center, Lake Murray area. We have commerce throughout the city of La Mesa that we need to pay attention to. Those communities need to be paid attention to. They're part of La Mesa just as much as the village is, and that we need to think of what we can do for those communities to serve them better. And it's more than just the commerce and economy and restaurants and storefronts. It is the complete feel of those communities that I want to pay attention to and figure out ways that we can improve and help those communities feel not only a part of La Mesa, but that they can prosper.
What are your ideas for easing the homelessness problem in La Mesa, especially during the pandemic when things like public restrooms and libraries are closed, there's no cool space for them to go? What more should our city be doing to get people off the streets and get them the help that they need?
Right. Well, let me start out with a principle or value. My faith has taught me in the worth and dignity of every person. So if they're homeless, they're a person that I am going to respect their worth and dignity. And we have to look at it from that perspective, start from that perspective, and figure out how to address the homeless issue. One thing that I think that some have often rushed to is, you know, we don't like the homeless. We don't want them in here. They're bad for our business. Can we find a place to put them someplace? Can we move them out? Can we move them to the next city, et cetera? So let's be upfront, or I want to be upfront from the beginning. That's not going to be my policy. I don't think we should be just simply moving someone away because we don't like the way they look in our neighborhood.
Studies locally have shown that most of the homeless people in East County became homeless in the cities that they're in. They didn't just come
exactly.
in from somewhere else because the weather is good.
Right. You're exactly right. They're actually La Mesans. They just don't own property or rent apartment, but they're part of La Mesa and they're not foreigners. So let's see if we can come up with ways to shelter them, at least give them a place to have a bathroom and a shower occasionally, and then find places where they can be sheltered and taken care of, along with a longer-term solution in terms of finding affordable housing and housing options. That includes everything from employment to taking care of them. Now, there's a one particular aspect or part of the homeless population to which unfortunately is probably going to be growing due to our current economic situation, downfall due to COVID-19, and that is mothers with children. There's no reason why we can't make extra, provide extra assistance to children and these families in terms of finding a way that at least they can keep up with their schoolwork in some way. At least we can find some way that they can find shelter, and we should be able to do that. We're not a depressed third world country or city here. We have resources.
Would you support something like what El Cajon just did this past week, where they voted to allow emergency sleeping cabins for homeless women and children and possibly others in the future? The first one is a little village of these kind of like tiny homes with a shared bathroom facility in this case. And that one is going on the property of a church that was willing to donate part of its church property for this purpose. Is that something that La Mesa might be able to do?
Sure. First of all, unfortunately, the city of La Mesa doesn't have a lot of expertise in this. Mm-hmm. City government doesn't. But our faith groups do. Mm-hmm. The Interfaith Shelter program that I've been involved with for over 25 years or so, they have some experience.
Yeah, these cabins only cost about $4,000 a piece to build. So it's just a matter of finding where to put them and then, you know, changing ordinances to make it
possible. Exactly. And we have faith organizations here in La Mesa that have been participating in programs to help the homeless. So there is some expertise here. That's one of the things that I found that La Mesa does have. We have a great number of people in La Mesa with all kinds of expertise and skills and abilities and a willingness to help. We saw that after the event on the 30th. People came from everywhere to
600 people with mops and buckets came out to clean up the next day. So that really does restore your faith and why it's great to be a La Mesan. I was born here. I'm pretty proud of the city and its residents. Despite everything that happened, they came together and you saw people of every color, every faith out there helping mm-hmm. with the cleanup. It's really very moving.
And we have the La Mesa Homelessness Task Force. There's experts there. We can go to them and say, let's expand this even further. They're able to get some grant funds. They're working on some projects. Let's support them further and give them even more resources and a larger charge in addressing the homelessness. I don't want to say that I'm an expert on any of this. Yeah. I'm certainly not expert on homelessness, but I think we can develop methodologies, strategies to bring in that expertise and move on some real aid.
You have advocated at actually a countywide, even statewide level on climate action issues. I'd like to get your comments on the City of La Mesa's climate action plan.
Yeah, I gave the climate action plan for the City of La Mesa a pretty low grade in public testimony over the past 5 years. We're doing pretty well on trying to have energy, non-polluting energy for our homes. I hope we progress on that quickly. Our main opponent to that is unfortunately our own provider, SDG&E. But we're going to community choice and moving along those lines, which is great.
So you would support La Mesa forming its own or joining one of the regional community choice aggregates to buy power from someone other than SDG&E?
To give us choice.
Rates, green energy?
Yes, and we are moving in that direction as part of the climate action plan, and the city is one of the ones that are forming a collaborative on community choice energy. So that's moving along. But the greatest source of pollution in our city that's affecting our health is the freeways that are cut through La Mesa. We have three of them, three major freeways that cut through. We now know, and we have known for over 10 years, 15 years, that we need to reduce the amount of driving that takes place. Electric cars alone, even though we need to move as fast as we can, is not going to bring the greenhouse gas emissions down fast enough. We have to reduce the amount of driving by 15%, actually 10 years ago. We're falling behind. We need to employ those strategies and the climate action plan for all the cities, including La Mesa, does not include any provisions of addressing regional drive-through traffic. It only deals with in-house traffic in the city of La Mesa. That's an error in the climate action plans, and we need to fix that. La Mesa needs to say, in our action plan, climate action plan, we're going to address people who are driving through the city or just on the freeways, that we're going to have influence to SANDAG, our regional transportation planning agency, with a mandate that we want that reduction, and we want it now. We need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 10 years ago. We should have done it 10 years ago. We're behind. We need to reduce the amount of traffic on 125 on Interstate 8 and 94 by 3-4% starting now. And we need to come up with systems to do that.
How would you do that if you were on SANDAG?
SANDAG has already proposed road pricing, and I can address that in terms of equity issues. It is equitable. What we have now is not equitable. What we have now is poor people paying for people to drive. So I've done a lot of research in this area. I think the evidence is very clear. We have to change what we're doing. You know, for a bottleneck that we have on 125 every morning and every afternoon, it's not a good situation, of course. It spills out all that pollution, causes more asthma, cancer, birth defects, and other ailments in our community. We can fix that real quickly now and not wait. In fact, we're not likely to get any expansion there because the state's not going to increase and widen 125. It can't because it will increase greenhouse gas emissions. So they're almost going to be prohibitive from fixing that. And if we do even fix it, it's going to cause more congestion elsewhere anyway. So it's not a real solution. We can make one of those lanes a diamond lane in both directions. That'll help ease traffic, maybe do congestion pricing. Those are things that our communities need to learn about and start moving in that direction.
The pandemic has drastically affected the city's budget and also led to discussions of who should get relief. Should it be businesses? Should it be renters? Can the city afford any of it? What would your budget priorities be, and how might they differ from what the current budget is for the city, Jack?
I'm going to want to put people first. And I know there was an interesting discussion between the businesses that needed relief with the small amount of money that the city got from the CARES Act, about $1.8 million. The city ended up with $600,000 going to rental relief and $1 million for businesses. It's not enough money really to help either category, nor help for the city budget as well, the $200,000 they gave to the city budget.
Right. They've had added costs too of
compliance. So there's expenses, it's a pretty hard situation because of obviously both renters and our businesses need assistance.
Yeah. It's like you cut off your left hand or your right, you know, businesses
exactly.
bring commerce into the city and sales taxes, and yet we don't want people out on the street and homeless if they're a renter.
But we know that in La Mesa, actually the majority of people in La Mesa rent. 54 to 56% of the people in La Mesa rent either in apartments or homes.
Interesting.
And Councilman Parent brought up during that discussion recently that over 500 people in La Mesa apply for renter's assistance from the city of San Diego. They weren't eligible, obviously, because it was the city of San Diego's program, but it shows the demand of renters' assistance here in La Mesa. With the allocation that they provided, the $600,000, they're going to be lucky to provide assistance to 100 people, 100 renters. So I think there is a disjunct in terms of where the need is and how we can go about helping those who are in need. Obviously, we need a lot more aid, and hopefully we can get that from the state or federal government. But the other thing that I'd like to bring up is we have all these great brains in La Mesa. Let's come together and come up with some better solutions and strategies. We're going to have a limited budget in La Mesa. We know that. How can we address this issue with the resources that we have? How can we seek more assistance from the federal government and from the state government and from the county? And work together to address these issues that are coming. These are big challenges that we're going to have.
One last question for you, Jack. You've been a consultant for cultural diversity. Given the divisive times that we have been in, La Mesa used to have a multicultural festival. They got rid of it. the year that they had their centennial because there was a conflict of having both of those in the same month, and somehow it never came back. Do you think when we get past the pandemic and there's a vaccine and we're allowed to hold public events again, is it time to bring back a multicultural festival or something like it to celebrate our diverse cultures in La Mesa?
So cultural diversity and celebrating our diversity is something that I think all cities should be doing, should be addressing. And there's many ways to do that. You could do it with food, which is always fun. You could do it with music, which is another way that people, you could do it with art. There's a lot of fun things we can do with cultural diversity. And I think if we take a few of those and run with it, not only will we be able to deal with diversity better, but we're going to have a lot more fun. And I think
we need that.
So let's approach it with that kind of a approach that, you know, diversity gives us all kinds of things. It gives us these fun things to work with and to either eat, dance, listen to music with, and party with. But it also gives us ability to solve problems and approach issues from a different way. So I think that's the other part of diversity we forget. Organizations, whether you're building cars, any kind of material mechanisms, they know throughout the world, successful organizations know that when they bring in a diverse workforce, they can solve those problems better. They can build a better car. We need to have the same kind of approach with diversity for our city. If we have a more diverse system within our city, we can solve our problems better.
Very good. Jack, I'm going to let you have the final say today on our Zoom call. And for those of you who may have tuned in late, we're speaking with Jack Hsu, who is a candidate for the La Mesa City Council. Jack, what else would you like our viewers to know? Or viewers and listeners, I should say, we'll be broadcasting this on KNSJ Radio as well.
Well, you know, there's going to be, each voter is going to have ability to vote for two candidates for this coming election. It's going to come up fast. And when you get your voter mail-in ballots in October, I want everyone to vote, or at least consider for me getting one of those votes. It's time that the city council have a voice like mine that can bring in some different thoughts, have a greater vision. And I know my vision is maybe pretty grand, that it's, when I say vibrant community from one end of the city to the other, people think, well, gosh, we're having problems right here, can we solve this? But, you know, leaving nobody behind, I think, is a value that we can adopt. This vibrant city is something that we need to head for. If we don't aim for that kind of vision, we're not going to get anything close to that. But if we do aim it, I think we could come pretty close. So that's what I bring to the city council. Let's aim higher. Let's do better. And I think we can do better, and we can serve our city in a much better way than it has been in the last 5-10 years.
Very good. Well, Jack Hsu, thank you so much for joining us today. And you can tune in and watch this entire interview. Share with your friends at eastcountymagazine.org.
Thank you.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producers, John Sepulveda and Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.